From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Do you enjoy going to work or not?
Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah, I have the memo right here. I just forgot, but it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
Yeah.
We will talk about the makings of a happy workforce and a workplace ahead this hour, but first, last week we got a commentary about how some media outlets report on extreme weather without mentioning climate change.
The head of state of a sovereign nation tried to bring up climate change as an impact for why part of his nation was destroyed, and he was cut off by a cable news anchor.
That's Peter Dykstra of Environmental Health News. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is Mary Bruzio. I am from Lithia Springs, Georgia. It's really frustrating to hear our president talk about climate change, even in terms of huge storms in the early 1900s, because it's proven that climate change has been occurring since our Industrial Revolution.
We always want to know what you think. You can give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. Or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the program. A recent Department of Labor study shows employed Americans spend more time working than anything else when they're awake. So what are we to make of the fact that so many of us say we dislike where we work and that not many of us love our jobs? The Atlanta Business Chronicle just released its annual list of the best places to work here in the city. And joining us to talk about what makes a company good to work for and keys to workplace happiness is Tom Conklin. He is Clinical Associate Professor of Managerial Sciences at Georgia State University. Tom, good to have you on the program.
Well, thanks a lot, Tony. Glad to be here.
So Tom, we want happier employees. We want happy workplaces. And you say there are essentially two key questions, right, in determining if yours is a happy workplace. And let's sort of take each question and talk about them separately, all right? Now, the first question is, do I have at least one person there at the workplace that I call a friend? Why is that important?
Well, actually, that's the two questions are two of actually 12.
Two of 12.
Yeah, which is really interesting. That's people, you know, work is a relational, social place.
Yep.
So people find that when they have a good friend at work, the likelihood of them leaving, the likelihood of turnaround ideation or leaving work sometimes drops precipitously. And so they find themselves sticking around more longer than they might otherwise have stayed there. So having a good friend at work, getting the chance to do what you do well at work, having good leadership and good management that provides the resources and tools, these are critical things that are assessed in terms of having a workplace where we find ourselves fully engaged.
You know, that's interesting because I when I think about the idea of having a friend at work, the other side of that, wait a minute. I don't go to work to make friends. I go to work to earn money. Mm-hmm. I go to work. I'm a bot. I go to produce.
Yeah.
I don't
crank
go
it
to
up.
Be social. I go to crank it up.
Increase efficiency, right? That's the model. That's the mantra. And what we've discovered is, well, that's true. We want to see high levels of productivity, but there are other issues that also play into that. And some of those things have to do with the nature of the work that we're doing.
Yeah.
Dorothy Marsick is a NYU prof, and she's written extensively on this idea also. And she says that manager's job, their job is not to make us happy, although they try hard and they should be respected for that. But really what it comes down to is the creation of meaning. And she says that's manager's job.
Creation of meaning.
Yeah, work that's meaningful, where we're doing stuff that we think really counts. And she says that's manager's job. But I say it is, but it's also our job. We can't.
Yeah.
It's too much to expect that strictly of management. So we have to participate in that ourselves in terms of creating a meaningful experience for ourselves.
Something meaningful. That gets to that other question of the 12 on the list here. Do I really enjoy what I do?
Mm-hmm.
Expand on that a little bit for us, for folks who are driving to work right now.
Yeah. Do I really enjoy what I do? And sadly, it seems like many folks don't, as you alluded to earlier. The sad reality is that we oftentimes find ourselves in jobs that really don't provide the significance or the meaning that we like. And sometimes that's a function of what we're actually doing. So the question is, how did I end up where I am?
Right.
And what could I do differently going into my work tomorrow or the next job? What should I think about? And that wrestles up all kinds of other questions that kind of make a mess
for us. But Tom, a lot of us don't think about the enjoyment path when we're thinking about a career. You know, we got out of school, we maybe have a degree and think we're going to get a job in that field, but we end up taking a job that gets us going and gets some money in our pockets immediately, and we don't think about the enjoyment path, I guess, to the extent that maybe you're suggesting we should.
Well, money is the thing that's the real problem. I mean, we live in a cash economy. I'm not going to deny it. Everybody wants to make a ton of dough. Me too. You too. That's normal. I get that. The challenge is, how can we balance the desire and the need for money in our economy with the inner drive to find work that leverages our unique capacity? And so if we can somehow suspend the money thing, and I'm in conversation with a couple of students, current and past students right now, about how they're evolving through their own elements around their careers and how they're doing things they don't want to do, and how do they have the courage to then move into areas that are more life-giving for them.
Yeah, I'm wondering what employees need to think about. You're heading to work now, and what am I contributing? I don't want to be the miserable person in an otherwise pretty happy workplace.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think figuring out what it is we do well is the first question. What do I do well?
That's a good one.
Yeah. And there are ways to do that. Gallup, again, they've done that's a huge organization that's done a lot of data collection. They do the polls. People know them for that. But they've done a lot of other things. And there's a whole story around developing our strengths, understanding what those are, academic research, Gallup's research on that, so we can figure out just, well, what am I good at? And I think most of us don't really know. We like to imagine it, or maybe we come up with some taken for granted, socially acceptable answers. But what are we really good at? And Gallup has about 36 different skills.
Or we think we're good at things that we may not be particularly good at, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, and it confronts this idea that says, well, I can be good at everything if I just try hard enough. that's in the American psyche, right? And so how can we get past that?
So what are your thoughts on what managers need to be thinking about? Because you talk to managers in your work and in your teaching. What is it that managers need to think about, and how difficult do we really appreciate how difficult a job it is to be a manager?
I don't think we do. I think that there's a lot of folks who aspire to be leaders and managers, and God bless them, they love it, it's great. But sometimes they forget about the part that the power, authority, and responsibility, those three things come together, and responsibility is what makes it work. That's what makes it really hard. A manager's job is to manage the organization, but the other part of a manager's job is she's also expected to develop the capacity of her staff to ascend through the organization, and that's a piece that gets dropped sometimes.
So we talked to some Atlantans, but I want to get back to that point you just made there at the end, because I think that's a good one.
Mm.
We talked to some Atlantans about their work environment, and I want you to hear from Benny Bierman, who has some ideas on what makes a good manager.
Mm. My name's Benny Bierbaum. I'm from Roswell, Georgia. One that doesn't like micromanage, but also gives you enough direction so you have an idea of where to go and what to do every day, so you're not sitting around.
That idea that you just mentioned, do you hear something in there that makes
absolutely
sense?
Absolutely. Oh, totally, completely. Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you hear there that resonates for you?
What I do makes sense. What I do is it makes a contribution, that it's not just whatever I spend my time at. I don't know where it came from. I don't know where it goes. But what I do makes a contribution to the larger program.
That idea of a manager being able to incorporate their people and working them up through the organization, do you find that enough managers appreciate how meaningful that is to the employee?
I think they do once they start managing.
Utilizing all of their skills of their employees?
Yes, but I think it's a practice, and it's an applied, it's like law, it's like medicine, it's like anything else, where we practice through the application of our skills and we build our capacity.
Yeah, I've got one more. This is from Tracy Aguirre. She's a Georgia Tech worker, and she's talking here about low morale.
Hi, my name is Tracy Gear. I work for a research security department here at Georgia Tech Research Institute. I've heard several experiences from other folks, and the environment wasn't so pleasant for them, meaning everybody's morale was low. The work is not a success. You know, people don't enjoy coming to work like they should.
So what do we want from good managers? And we'll get back to employees in a moment here. It seems to me we want managers who are open-minded.
Yeah.
We don't want them siloed in their thinking.
No, we don't. We want them to think broadly. We want them to give us work that's uses the skills that we have, and that's the thing that's most critical. I've talked to many students and many organizations, members and organizations, where feel like they're not doing the work that they're really built for. So. And this is what makes management really hard. If we're really going to do the job well, it means we have to really understand our faculty, our staff, our faculty, whoever it is that's in our service, right? So we have to understand, what are they built for? Why are they here? Here's a crazy idea. What is their calling? That's an old idea from 400 or 500 years ago, but it's finding a resurgence now in conversations. It's finding a resurgence in literature. But it takes a lot of work to figure out what that is. And I'm just talking to a student right now, and I'm having to rehash her entire life and find out what she found most life-giving in wherever she's been, jobs, activities, events, wherever. And that's the easy part. You know, that's paying attention. The tough part is then once you find it, the courage then to go pursue it, especially going back to what we talked about a few minutes ago when it comes to cash flow and money. Like sometimes I'm going to have to be broke for a little while to do that work.
So Tom, and if you're just joining us, we're talking to Tom Conklin. He's a clinical associate professor of managerial sciences at Georgia State University. What do you hear as being the chief frustrations of managers who you did some consulting work earlier in your career? What is it that you would hear from managers in terms of their frustrations and the difficulties they were having in managing their staff?
Trying to find a way to get their staff to do their jobs more fully involved.
Really?
And sometimes, and then, of course, the approaches that they take are sometimes foolhardy. They think, well, if I pay them a lot, I'll give them raises, I'll give them more money. And money's important. Like we said earlier, we got to have it. At the same time, money is only, it doesn't make us happy. It just makes our unhappiness more tolerable. What really makes us happy is autonomy, meaning, purpose in our work, the ability to do work that we feel fits into the larger project of the organization. There's research done on the idea of what folks find meaningful, and money is oftentimes what managers think, whereas staff say, I just want to be involved at the higher level. I want to know what's going on around here.
Yeah. Are there companies that you've identified? The Atlanta Business Chronicle has certainly identified companies that are doing it well here in the Atlanta area. But are there other companies that you're aware of or best practices out there that you're aware of that you can share with us?
Companies, one comes to mind right off the top of my head. Georgia State University.
Yeah. We were talking about that. I know that'll sound like we're being homers here, but we were talking about that just moments ago.
Yeah. I mean, as I'm 5 years at that university, and I got to say they have done a lovely job of reconstructing faculty positions, for instance, in terms of what people do really well and then loading those capacities. So I think taking that and not saying, you know, taking a one-size-fits-all approach to whatever the job title is, and then really sort of understanding how the job can leverage the unique strengths that that person has. So it takes, that's why management's hard, because we got to care enough to figure that out. And there's some tools out there. So clearly
people
some research.
Get frustrated when they feel like, look, I came here to do a job, I have all these skills, and I'm siloed.
Yeah.
Forget about siloed thinking from the managers. I'm siloed. They don't fully appreciate the entire person and being and what I can contribute.
Right.
Right?
Right.
That's frustrating.
That's frustrating. And managers, you know, I don't want to give them the bad rap here, because they're trying to meet their expectations and they have pressure from above. I get all that too. So this is why I say management is such a difficult role, because they are trying to meet their boss's expectations and still take care of their staff in ways that help them achieve their magnificence.
Well, I hope we helped someone on the way to work or who's at the job right now. Tom, it's great to have you on the program.
Well, thanks so much for having
me,
Tony.
Yeah, real pleasure. Tom Conklin, he's a clinical associate professor of managerial sciences at Georgia State University. And just ahead on the program, Georgia-based food writer Jonathan Scott Barrett joins us to talk Southern cooking. But first, a look into Wesleyan College's checkered past and ties to the Klan. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. Wesleyan College in Macon has a largely distinguished history, but it is no stranger to racial tension. In January, racist remarks were found scrawled on a dormitory wall. Since then, information has been made public about the school's past ties to the Ku Klux Klan. That history came to light as part of research by students at Wesleyan. I talked about this in July with Wesleyan history professor Karen Huber, who led the student effort to learn more about racist episodes in the school's past. Dana Ammon here joined the discussion. She's an interactive editor for the Dallas Morning News and a Wesleyan College alum.
Good to be here.
Dana, let me start with you. We're going to spend the first few minutes here sort of dissecting what you and Karen learned, what you uncovered. But take me back to 2006. You were, I believe, a freshman at Wesleyan.
Yes.
You're sleeping one night, and what wakes you up?
Well, what wakes me up is the sound of my dorm mates all herding to the auditorium on campus. When you walk in, it's dark. There are drums beating. There are girls chanting and screaming, and there are girls lined up on stage in purple robes with hoods. It's sort of just a surreal experience.
What did you make of it? How was it explained to you?
There wasn't a whole lot of explanation at the time. Huh. It was just sort of a little bit of a free-for-all. I started getting pieces of information over the next few days that it was a ritual of the college to bring together the first-year class. But from what I experienced, it had a very strange way of trying to bring everyone together.
Strange meaning what? What did you come to understand that ritual to be?
So the ritual is actually known as Lynx. It used to be known as Rats. Basically, the sophomore class takes it upon themselves to teach the underclassmen about the traditions of Wesleyan, teach us cheers and things, but it's done through a bit of scare tactics. It's the sophomores trying to exert control over the freshman class in kind of mean ways, like just being very passive aggressive, wanting us to do things for them without question, that sort of thing.
Karen, let me come to you. How did your research project start?
Well, in 2015, I was teaching a public history class, and I asked the students what they were interested in doing, and this group of students was particularly interested in looking at the history of race at Wesleyan, and in particular, the history we didn't talk about. So there's a lot of talk about the first five African-American graduates who started at Wesleyan in 1968. They wanted to look at African-Americans at Wesleyan before the first five. So we started to do research on employees and even enslaved people who would have worked at the college or been enslaved by the college. And we tried to find evidence about that, and that eventually led us to looking at a much larger project that took in the long view of race and some really problematic history that we found from the college.
And Dana, look, I want to push you on this a little bit here. For more than a century, you came to realize that your school, the nation's oldest college, mm-hmm. chartered for women, had this historical linkage to the Klan. When did
yes.
that become clear for you?
That became clear for me actually working for the Office of Admissions, starting the end of my freshman year. And into the rest of my years at Wesleyan. One of the things that we were tasked with doing was giving campus tours to prospective students. And part of that was being able to answer their questions. So I had questions myself in order to be able to help them about the history of the school and things as simple as where our class names came from.
Yes.
So it was a little surprising to me to find out that our Red Pirate class, since every class has a name and a color, used to be called the Tri-K's, and immediately bells go off in my head that Tri-K's, I grew up in the South, I mean, it's Ku Klux Klan, this is not hard to put together, but it's something that's just not really talked about.
What was your emotional reaction to learning this?
I was stunned. I was really stunned, but at the same time, I was a little irritated that nobody really talked about this, that it was just sort of, it was something that I really had to push to get answers about.
Karen, how did this linkage come to be, this linkage between the college and the Klan? What does your research tell us?
Well, this was one of the key questions that I wanted to answer when I continued with the research that my students started. So I was commissioned by the college to actually figure this out this past year. And what I found was that in 1909, the first class graduated that claimed the KKK Ku Klux Klan name. And that group seems to have been inspired by a series of novels written by Thomas Dixon in 1902, 1905, and 1908 that were immediately turned into plays. The plays were played in Macon in 1905 and 1908 as The Klansman and The Traitor. And those plays inspired the 1915 film, The Birth of the Nation. So these are plays that very much romanticize and glorify the Ku Klux Klan, which at the time was in kind of a lull. And so it looks as though these women may have had relatives who were also Klan members from their earlier, more active years after the Civil War and through Reconstruction. But it looks as though these women came back from this fun play with 75 people on stage and two boxcars of scenery that was a major social event in Macon, and decided that this is what they wanted to model their class name after. And the really troubling part is that these women made this decision that was not changed until very late in the century.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about a troubling racial past at Wesleyan College in Macon. Karen Huber is a history professor there, and Dana Amahir is a Wesleyan College alum. She's joining us from Dallas. Professor Huber, did the college at any point attempt to shut down this research?
No, they paid for it, in fact. So I know that I've heard since this research came out from students who felt like they, in the past, have not been given access. However, you know, it would be very bad if they denied access to a professional historian who's on the faculty. So my experience hasn't been one of denial, although I respect and want to acknowledge that there are students who have had a different experience of that.
Yeah.
So, no, they haven't shut me down. They actually supported it. But, you know, it's late. We should have done this years ago. I think Dana's article that she wrote as a student in 2009, that might have been the first time I heard about this. But certainly there were people on campus who knew about it before that. And, you know, in my research, I've found evidence from 1948 when there was an article in the class newspaper where they talked about whether or not they ought to rename the class and whether or not KKK still stood for Ku Klux Klan. And they bring up the idea that, oh, well, maybe now it's about, let's see, what is it? Catherine's Campus Cuties, named after some professor. So they seem to think that you can just sort of erase it and make it stand for anything.
So your new president, Vivia Fowler, is quoted saying essentially what you just said. We probably should have done it 20 years ago, and the it is apologize. But we didn't. So we're doing it now. We can't ignore what happened in the past. Dana, why has it taken so long with all of this now documented history to apologize?
I wish I knew. I know that the resources that I had available to me when I was a student and when I was editor of the campus newspaper, all of this information lived in our archives, but no one ever decided to acknowledge that this material existed, or that it tracked a less than perfect history of Wesleyan. Even when you start to ask questions, it was not exactly encouraged for you to go seek out these things. It was more of a, you know, they're there. That's not really something that we need to talk about. I think it's long overdue. It's so long overdue, and it's something that could have been easily addressed, I think, years and decades ago.
Do you have a thought on that, Karen?
Yeah, I agree with Dana. I actually, the process of watching my students in 2015 go through the archives and find this material and, you know, find evidence, you know, they found evidence of us hiring out a slave boy in 1861, an enslaved person who, you know, was hired out, which means that Wesleyan's faculty and Porter paid his master, not him, to work on the college. All of that was very empowering to the students as they did this research, and it would have been a great learning process to have had students go through much earlier. So I think that Dana's right, that there was this sense on campus of not wanting to talk about it, but we're late to the game, but now we want to talk about it, and we're going to make sure that happens.
Sure. And this is more of a statement from the Wesleyan administration. During the process, quoting now, during the process of uncovering and discussing our institution's past, we have learned of many things we still need to work on today. We are committed to inclusion, equality, and social justice for every member of the Wesleyan community. We hope that all members of our community will help us move forward with our goal of creating a community where all are able to know, trust, learn from, and care for one another. Our story is one of hope, where the lessons of history make us stronger, end quote. So, Karen, what does moving forward look like?
Well, that's a good question, and that's actually my part of moving forward means listening and asking questions. This is where I'd love to use your venue to say to any Wesleyan alums out there that I have two classes who are getting trained next month on how to conduct oral history interviews, and we would love to collect the stories from Wesleyans of all ages who have stories to tell us either about race or just their experience in general. And we'd love to hear from them to get a more complete picture. We only have the picture of the documents that are in our archives right now, and we want to hear from everybody. So that's part of it, is just listening. But I think we also need to take a really hard look at the privilege that those of us who are white and middle class and educated have, and think about ways that we can acknowledge that privilege and help others who don't have that privilege navigate our world better. And I think that's something we kind of ignore in our little Wesleyan bubble.
Dana, what are your thoughts on this? What does moving forward look like?
I am really, really, I'm touched by the fact that Dr. Huber's research and her students are looking to find oral histories of other Wesleyans. I'm hoping that that by finding all of these different voices of alums, that we can find some more diverse voices to add to the conversation. And by having those more diverse voices, hopefully that will motivate the administration and folks on campus to make this a constant ongoing discussion rather than something that's more like a one and done conversation. I hope it's something
that's
that
absolutely important.
Yeah, I'm hoping that it's something that can get weaved into the fabric of Wesleyan and not be something that is just a one-off.
Yeah, so, this can't just be a unit in the first year seminar. This has to be something we do every day, that we live every day.
So I guess I wonder about the commitment to that, because that all sounds great. But Professor Huber, look, your new president has been at the school for 10 years.
Yes.
Your outgoing president, Ruth Knox, in charge for what, 10, 15 years?
15 years.
15 years. What's the real commitment moving forward? These were people who were in positions of power who clearly knew something of the history, if they didn't know it in great detail, and yet we're just getting the apology. We're just now talking about moving forward. What's your real belief in the ability of the college and its leadership to move a more inclusive agenda forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. When we look at Wesleyan today and we look at our student body and we look at what we're trying to do with our curriculum, we don't resemble even 15 years ago, even 10 years ago when I started working there. We are trying to change, but, you know, we are now a minority-serving institution. We have a diverse student body. We have to do this or we're going to fail. We're going to stop being a relevant institution. So this isn't really a choice for us. We have to do this. And so I think this for us is a matter of realizing that there have definitely been some serious omissions in the past. I can't get into President Knox or President Fowler's head, but I think that there is a commitment from the new president. We have a new president, a new provost, and a new dean of students, and all three of them have a commitment to really making this a centerpiece of what we do as we move forward.
Is there more to learn here, Professor Huber, in your research? Is there another shoe or a couple of shoes to drop here?
Well, I don't think we're going to find something more than the Klan. I mean, you can't get much worse than that.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, as we move forward and look at the practices, especially the initiation practices that Dana mentioned, and the year we ended that, which was 1999, I think I had the opportunity to witness that, and I agree with her. It was really troubling. So as we move forward, I think we have to have a serious conversation about whether or not that name, the Pirates, which yeah. was the Tri-K Pirates, remains. And we also have to have a conversation about the way that we interact on campus and don't think about it. And we need to start talking about those interactions in a more serious way.
Well, thank you both. Thank you both for a wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
That's Karen Huber.
Thanks a lot.
She's a professor of history at Wesleyan College. Also with us was Dana Amahir, Wesleyan alum and now an interactive editor for the Dallas Morning News. Thank you both. Enjoyed this. Just ahead, the stories behind the recipes of Southern cooking. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we go behind the scenes to see what's filming in Georgia, and there is plenty filming in Georgia. Jennifer Brett of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution gives us a lowdown on the latest projects in Yollywood. So we'd love to hear about your celebrity encounters in Georgia. You can give us a call, leave us a message at 404-500-9457. And you can find us on Twitter or on Facebook, and then be sure to tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. You know, when I was a kid, I'd visit my dad in Philadelphia, and one of my favorite memories of our time together, aside from watching wrestling and roller derby on TV, although we didn't call it wrestling, he called it wrestling. Wrestling, yeah, was of his rice pudding. He'd cook it, and it would have to sit and cool seemingly forever before I could dig in. I really love that rice pudding. My mouth is watering just thinking about it. My dad died in 1990, but whenever I see rice pudding on a menu, because I don't cook, whenever I see it on a menu somewhere, I think of him. So memories like that one for me are at the heart of the latest book by my next guest. Food writer Jonathan Barrett is author of the new book, Cook and Tell, and he joins me in our Atlanta studio. Jonathan, good to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. I'm honored to be here.
And also with us is Amy Condon. She's the founder of the Refinery Writing Studio in Savannah and contributed her own story to Jonathan's book. Amy is also a regular on our weekly segment, The Breakdown. Amy, good to have you on the program.
Good morning, y'all. Good to talk to you.
It's good to have you here, Amy, and I've got some questions for you in a moment. But first, Jonathan, what a great idea for a book and these stories, the stories behind the recipes. I mean, where did the idea come from?
Well, my first book that I had was called Rise and Shine. It was a food memoir. And actually, it was on this program with Celeste two years ago talking about it. And I went on a book tour and met all these people from across the South. And at each stop at all these different book festivals or different speaking engagements, people would during the Q&A and then even afterward, would come up to me and tell me the stories about their family, just like you just shared with us about your dad and the rice pudding. You know, and it would be amazing just to hear all the things that that they had to share. And it was also personal, and it was always usually so very warm. And so when I finished the book tour, my publisher said something to the effect of, you know, what do you want to do next? And I was like, well, I've already got it ready. I've already told my stories about food and growing up. Let me tell other people's stories. Let me share theirs. And that's how this book came about.
And you decided to, the approach, maybe talk about the approach. It was, you've got professionals.
Yes.
And you've got non-professionals.
Exactly.
So how did you determine that that would be your approach for this book?
Well, I did want to balance in that because there were so many people too that that I didn't know that were professional chefs and authors and people that I met on the book tour that were fabulous, and they had wonderful stories. But there were so many other folks that I met and that I knew growing up, or that I just knew personally, that were fabulous cooks. They were only famous within their own kitchen, or maybe within their own town. But the thing about it is, when you look at some of these famous chefs that we have out there, they all came from very small towns too. For a number of them, I mean, they had the roots that these same people that aren't well known. And so they got their start in their mother's or their grandmother's kitchen.
Yes, yes.
And so I just wanted to be able to share those stories from people that that didn't have they weren't published,
right.
But they had fabulous dishes and they had incredible stories.
Well, speaking of sharing, I want you to share. I want you to read a little bit.
Okay.
Okay. This is a bit from A Cook and Tell, and set up the portion of one of your stories that you're going to read for us.
Yes, and this particular chapter is contributed by Michael Morris, and Michael is one of a known author. He's an incredible Southern writer from Perry, Florida, and he wrote A Place Called Wiregrass and Slow Way Home, and he's talking in his story about his maternal grandmother who helped raise him, and they had a very close relationship. And I'll read a portion of his story here now.
Okay, great.
People say that music has memory. We can be anywhere at any given time and hear a certain song that transports us to another place in our lives. For me, food has that same effect. Anytime I smell chicken frying, I return to my grandparents' house. My grandmother was called Mother because she declared she was too young to be called anything else when her grandchild was born. My favorite meal was not only Mother's fried chicken, but also a cream corn she'd cook on the stove, and then right before it was done, she'd place a skillet briefly in the oven. All these years later, I can still picture that plate of chicken, the skillet of corn, and a platter of freshly sliced tomatoes sprinkled with just the right amount of salt. The food was displayed like gallery art on a kitchen table ordered from a Sears and Roebuck catalog.
I wanted you to read just a portion of it because it puts you immediately right into the stories, right into the book. It's really good stuff. And Amy, you know, share with us what you wrote about, what you shared for the book.
Well, I wrote about my mom's chicken pot pie, which does not sound like a special meal at all, but it became our welcome home meal to each other because I moved away from Fort Worth, Texas in 1993. And when I would come home for visits, we would either go out for Tex-Mex to my favorite place in the stockyards, or she would make me chicken pot pie. And what it became is our way of welcoming each other. So when she would come visit me, that would be the dish I would make for her, too. And as I got more confident in the kitchen, I would start putting my own spin on things. And sometimes I would hear her go, well, that's nice. or sometimes I still to this day hear her going, you need to be cutting those vegetables smaller. You know, like I can hear her. But the reason why I picked this particular dish for me is because there's this great line by Terry Pratchett, the writer, that something about like no man is dead while his name is still spoken. And I feel like my mom's chicken pot pie is the way of consistently speaking her name.
Wow.
Because when we celebrated her last birthday, it was her 70th birthday, most of the women in our family gathered here in Savannah to celebrate it. We rented a beach house because she had just finished her final round of chemo, and she was really, really weak, but we wanted her. She loved the beach more than anything, and so we made her birthday dinner, and we made chicken pot pie and her favorite chocolate cake. And then after she died that following December, and I came back from Texas from the funeral, the first thing I made was the chicken pot pie. So it's one of these dishes that brings great comfort, but it also just makes me think of home. So if I'm ever just sort of itching to be home and can't get there or something like that, or I have friends coming over, I just, you know, something that just makes them feel as warm and kind of like a hug as much as her, that's what I made, and so that's why I wanted to share that with other people.
Oh, man, that is so well told. That is so well told. So if you're just joining, if you're just joining us,
I'm a little teary. Sorry.
Really? Well, while I've got you in this place, I'm going to follow up with another question. Then, so I guess I want to know what aspects of your mom's story, write her life, your relationship with your mom. It comes rushing back when you're actually on the occasions when you're in the kitchen and you actually cook the recipe.
So when my mom and I were such different personalities. She was very shy. In fact, most of her life, even if it was a family event, she wanted to be in the kitchen, whereas I wanted to be talking to everybody. She was really shy. But the one place we actually connected more than any place was over food. Like, we would plan trips based on where could you get the best hamburger between Miami and Texas, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So when I am making this dish, I'm always sort of thinking about, you know, I think of her hands more than anything, because she thought the best thing ever was to do something homemade for somebody. Like, she made cakes for birthday cakes for people at this place called Samaritan House in Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm.
If they were people basically, you know, in the last stages of AIDS. And she would make their birthday cakes for them as a volunteer.
Yeah.
And so I always think of her hands and how she would cut things in these tiny little cubes and how she would stir. And I can always sort of hear her over my shoulder going, now you want to keep moving that. You don't want to let it sit. It'll get too thick. like that. So I just always feel like she's there with me when I'm making this.
So that's Amy Condon. She's the founder of the Refinery Writing Studio in Savannah. And Jonathan Barrett is here. He is the author of the new book, Cook and Tell. And we're talking about the stories contributed by professional chefs, non-professional people who love to cook, to this new book. And it's a terrific book. And I think you get a sense of that in listening to Amy. And Jonathan, who is Nancy Fulbright?
Nancy is a buddy of mine and Amy. She's originally from Macon, Georgia, and grew up right up the road from me. I'm from Perry, and as I said, she's a classic country music aficionado. She's a wonderful writer. She's a great cook, but again, she's not a professional cook.
Right.
But she writes a story about her grandmother, Earlene, and her incredible fried peach pies, and I had so many people that contributed stories about fried pies. Actually, I have three combined in one chapter, but Nancy, and also is a PR executive, but she's a fabulous Southerner in terms of cooking and stories, and she has a great story.
I want you to hear from, I want everyone to hear a bit of the story. So Nancy obviously contributed to the book, and she writes about her grandmother's peach tarts, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when Nancy's sister died a few years ago, she actually remembers making the grandmother's peach tart recipe. And here she is talking about what an emotional experience that was for her.
I ended up just standing in my kitchen crying. I guess I was thinking that, you know, my sister should have been the one doing it. But it's such a great way to, like, pay tribute and to honor my grandmother and the women who came before me in the kitchen. And I felt this real obligation to my Aunt Margie, the last surviving sibling, to really get it right. So I did feel a little bit of pressure.
You know, I actually feel like I want to button up that story a bit. So here is Nancy making the point that simply recreating her grandmother's peach tart, recreating that recipe wasn't quite enough.
I like to eat them like the next day after they've, you know, set out on paper towels and have it with a cup of coffee, and it's just like room temperature. But, you know, and that's the way, like, I remember eating it at my grandmother's. So it just, like, takes you back in time, and it connects you to that person again, even though they've been gone 20 years or however long they've been gone.
You know, Jonathan, the stories in this book will certainly resonate with everyone, I think, and probably for different reasons. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But what stories had you sort of laughing, shaking your head in agreement?
You know, it's interesting. Probably every single one of them. I've got one from...
Mama Jenny comes to mind. What's the Mama Jenny?
Big Mama Jenny is my buddy Wes Goodrow's grandmother. she was known as Big Mama, and I've got a whole chapter in here too called "Big Mamas: The South's Titled Nobility." And I say in the chapter too for folks that if you're not from the South, you might automatically think that Big Mama means that the woman was large. That's not necessarily so. It might just mean that she had an incredibly imposing personality. So, you know, she was just a strong lady, and that's one of the things that Martha Nesbitt from Savannah says about her Big Mama. She said she was one lady you didn't mess with, but Big Mama Jenny was my friend Wes Goodrow's grandmother, and made the most incredible banana pudding, and his story was about that, but more so than just the pudding was the fact that they had the type of relationship that, and he wrote about coming home. While he was in college, he would just leave college to campus some afternoons and go visit with his grandmother. They would walk the farm, or they'd go fishing, and the relationship that they had. And it was those wonderful stories. And it came about when I was talking with Wes about this and about the book, and he was telling me about Big Mama Jenny. I said, "That's a fabulous story. I really want you to share it." And he said, "You know, Jonathan, I'm not a writer. I wasn't really good in composition class in high school. You remember that?"
Yeah.
I said, "Wes, don't worry about that. I said, just sit down with pen and paper or sit at your keyboard, write out what you remember, what you remember that was special. Put into your own words. Don't worry about where a comma is placed or what the composition looks like. Just write what you feel and remember." It was the most beautiful story when it was finished, and I probably only had to move maybe a period to do a little, change words, just very little in that. I mean, because it came from his heart. And so that's the thing that's special about these stories in here are the voice of the people that have written them. And so that's what I've left it.
Oh, Amy's comes through. I mean, you know, I've read more than a few of them. And Amy, your voice really comes through in your writing. When you had an opportunity to read some of the other stories in the book, what a terrific approach to talking about Southern cooking.
I feel like I know these people, even if I haven't met them. That's the glorious thing, is that you feel like, oh, already I've broken bread with them. Mm-hmm. I'm already in communion. And it feels like a big old potluck, in a way, that, I've, you know, like we've got a big old heavy table full of all these dishes.
Yeah. You know, before we go, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you both for your thoughts on Savannah and how the city is bouncing back, recovering from Irma. Jonathan, your thoughts first.
Savannians are very resilient, and so even in the face of adversity, they make the best of things. There's been a lot of water damage there. There's a lot of trees that are down and people that have been without power. But everybody's rallied. I think they're doing really well. They always through storms like this, Savannah pulls through. So, and Amy's been there longer than Amy did not evacuate. I did. I hightailed it.
Amy, a quick thought from you.
What I have recognized is how people have come to the aid of each other. Mm-hmm. That whether it's making dinners for people who were without power, if you were lucky enough to have power.
Yeah.
A couple of people I know, water really got into their house. And people have given them shelter as well as gone in and cleaned out the rack and the water that has come up into their houses. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, really seeing how people show up for one another is something that, and
that's terrific.
This day and time, you just kind of go, oh, good.
Yeah, they usually
we're still there. We still have that.
Well, thank you.
I was going to say they showed up with a dish in their hand, too, with some fried chicken or pound cake.
Well, thank you both. Amy, thank you. And Jonathan,
thank you.
The book is Cook and Tell. I hope you read it. It's a terrific read. And thank you both. Thank you both. And that's our show for today. But we want to hear from you. We talked about how cooking can be a way to preserve family stories. Tell us about a recipe that holds pretty special meaning and memories for you. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headley, and for today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.